KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Candidate Trump said he had nothing to do with the conservative agenda called Project 2025. As president, he's pursued many policies straight from their playbook. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump's threat to impose tariffs on Mexican and Canadian imports could start tomorrow. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Lots of businesses are anxiously waiting, but what will it mean for prices of the stuff you like to buy? Also, 5 years ago, a Los Angeles County firefighter thought he had terminal cancer and told StoryCorps about a girl he once saved. Turns out he was misdiagnosed, and now he's back talking with her about their second chances at life. It's Friday, January 31st. Singer Justin Timberlake is 44 years old. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Federal investigators have retrieved the cockpit voice and flight data recorders from the American Airlines jet that collided with an Army helicopter Wednesday night near Washington, D.C. 67 people died in the crash. NPR's Frank Langfitt has more.
The so-called black boxes, which are actually orange in color, will allow investigators to hear the final conversations in the cockpit before the two aircraft collided over the Potomac River. They'll also provide crucial data, including the altitude of the plane leading up to and at the time of the collision. Once investigators have the recorder from the Black Hawk helicopter, they'll have a better sense of the paths the aircraft took that led to the crash. Officials tell NPR that the Black Hawk was supposed to be flying no higher than 200 feet, while sources say it was flying at least 100 feet higher. Meanwhile, members of the crew of the American Airlines jet have been identified. They include First Officer Sam Lilly, a second-generation pilot who was engaged to be married. Lilly's father, Tim, wrote this on Facebook: "It hurts so bad, I can't even cry myself to sleep." Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
Among key and contentious confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill yesterday for President Trump's cabinet picks, Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence. Some senators focused on the Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel's previous comments criticizing U.S. involvement abroad, especially in the Middle East, and that she met with ousted Syrian President Assad. Senator Mark Kelly.
So my big concerns with Colonel Gabbard is, you know, that she's contradicted our own intelligence community on Assad's use of chemical weapons against his own people. And then she also has this propensity to use information as if it's true when it comes from, you know, dictators like Putin and Assad in Syria.
Speaking there to NPR, Kelly says Gabbard is a patriot who served and cares about this country, but he says he doesn't feel she's up to this job. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a jump in personal spending last month. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Personal spending jumped by 0.7% in December as Americans spent more on both goods and services. Personal income was also up during the month, but not as much. Many people dipped into savings or borrowed money to finance their additional spending. The already low personal savings rate fell further in December to 3.8%. The Commerce Department's inflation yardstick, which is closely watched by the Federal Reserve, shows prices in December were up 2.6% from a year ago. That's a slightly larger annual increase than the previous month. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Tokyo but down in Seoul. Markets in Hong Kong and Shanghai remain closed for the Lunar New Year. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And the Dow is up 32 points right now. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. NASA's two stranded astronauts got a change of scenery, stepping out for the first time together 260 miles above the Earth. NPR's Amy Held reports on the historic spacewalk outside the International Space Station.
Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams' time aboard the orbiting lab was supposed to last about a week this summer. They're still there. For what's looking like a 10-month stay after their ride, the Boeing Starliner experienced leaks and other problems. So it's understandable they'd want to get out and stretch their legs. That's just what they did Thursday for 5.5 hours on their first joint spacewalk.
Sonny Williams works on the removal.
Successfully removing a stubborn broken antenna, narrated by Mission Control.
Has been attempted to be removed on two previous.
Williams already performed a spacewalk earlier this month, but this, her ninth overall, broke a record for the most time spent on a spacewalk for any female astronaut. NASA says she and Wilmore will return to Earth by late March at the earliest aboard a SpaceX capsule. Amy Held, NPR News.
1,000 endangered sea turtles have been rescued in Florida. Officials with the state's Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission say the endangered reptiles were suffering because of a rare winter storm in the area that sent water temperatures plunging. The turtles' flippers were paralyzed and they couldn't come up for air, but the wind and currents carried their bodies ashore where they were rescued. Officials say it was among Florida's biggest cold water turtle rescues in the last 15 years. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The busy skies above Ronald Reagan Airport, the site of this week's deadly mid-air collision, has raised safety concerns for years. Michael McCormick is familiar with that airspace. He's a former vice president of the FAA Air Traffic Organization, and he was in charge of airspace security for the U.S., including in the Washington region. So, Michael, I mean, this is a particularly crowded piece of airspace. I mean, right outside the nation's capital, very close to the Pentagon. So military helicopters such as that Black Hawk involved in Wednesday's crash routinely fly through there. Does that make it challenging for air traffic controllers to ensure safe conditions?
Absolutely. The airspace in and around Washington, D.C. is very complex and very unique in its challenges in the United States and globally. That makes it a challenge for both commercial pilots to fly in and out of Washington National, and a challenge for the controllers who have to operate within that airspace and at that airport.
Now, what do you think investigators will be looking for when they analyze the cockpit voice and flight data recorders that they recover from the passenger jet?
I believe the prime information that the investigators want to try to come to is what were the pilots seeing and what were they doing?
And do you think we'll be able to get a good sense of that once all that data is analyzed?
At least from the American flight with the cockpit voice recorder and the black box recovery, they'll be able to pick up what the conversation was going on in the cockpit, what the pilot and co-pilot were saying to each other, what they were looking at, and if they were concerned at all about the helicopter. We'll have more of a challenge to try to do that with forensic data from the helicopter, since they are not normally equipped with cockpit voice recorders.
Wow. Okay. Now, there are questions, though, being raised about air traffic control staffing at the DCA tower. It's not unusual for controllers to sometimes work multiple roles at the same time. It isn't necessarily dangerous either. But, Michael, what do you think? I mean, could staffing levels have contributed to what happened on Wednesday?
Staffing levels for air traffic controllers is a problem across the country. Due to budget shortfalls, lapses in budgeting, and the COVID pandemic, the FAA has had numerous stops to its hiring and training of air traffic controllers, and that has led to a nationwide shortage, just not at Washington National. Washington National is not a chronically understaffed facility in the United States. It is a popular facility for air traffic controllers to want to work at. So staffing really isn't a problem at Washington National and probably did not contribute to this event.
Okay. You know, Michael, I've flown into that exact airport many times when I visit NPR's HQ, and I've always wondered how much sense it makes to have an airport so close to so many sensitive buildings, such as the Pentagon, the White House, the Capitol building. I mean, has that ever been thought of, like that all these aircraft are flying around all these sensitive buildings?
Certainly that was a question that was asked and answered after September 11, 2001. The role that Washington National plays in the economy of Washington, D.C., the regional economy, and the convenience of the passengers that fly in and out of Washington eliminates the possibility of shutting down Washington National Airport. Instead, the process was to develop the necessary security protocols in and around Washington, D.C. to ensure that there would not be any sort of action similar to September 11, 2001. And I'm not concerned about anything happening to Washington, D.C. because of Washington National Airport remaining open.
All right. Michael McCormick is the former vice president of the FAA Air Traffic Organization. He now teaches at Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. Michael, thanks.
Thank you. Have a good day.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump swore he had nothing to do with the conservative policy agenda known as Project 2025, even called the proposals absolutely ridiculous. Just 2 weeks in office, he's enacting a whole bunch of the policies outlined in their 900-page playbook. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been looking at where the policies align and where they do not. So, Franco, in case people forgot, remind us what Project 2025 is.
Yeah, a Project 2025 is a plan pulled together by a number of conservative groups and headed by the think tank, the Heritage Foundation. It had some pretty extreme proposals, and during the campaign, it really kind of turned into this flashpoint with Democrats zeroing in on some of those extreme measures, and which went viral as well, and all the hubbub really led Trump to kind of disavow the whole thing.
Now, many of the policies, though, are popping up in Trump's early nominations and executive actions. So tell us more about the overlap you're seeing.
Yeah, the overlap is in personnel as well as policy. Many former Trump officials were involved with it and are getting into office again. Russ Vogt, for example, was one of the key authors of Project 2025. He was also Trump's budget director in the first administration, and he's been tapped to return in the same job as director of the Office of Management and Budget. And while he's not yet confirmed, Vogt has already played a key role in some of the president's biggest directives that are creating a lot of confusion, such as the order to pause federal funding. Of course, that order was rescinded, but the idea came from Project 2025. Also part of Project 2025 was the proposal to end birthright citizenship, as well as diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Project 2025 also offers details, plans to reshape the federal workforce, including instituting a hiring freeze and reclassifying workers.
Now, I mean, Franco, almost all presidents get policy ideas from think tanks, so why should any of this matter?
Yeah, I mean, that is very true. I mean, I think the part of this that got so much attention was Trump's disavowal of the plan. Critics are basically accusing Trump now of a bait and switch. That said, politically, it's also given Democrats a little bit of life to attack the president, especially as it related to the chaos created by the funding freeze. I mean, here is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer saying that what Democrats warned about before is now coming true.
Plain and simple, this is Project 2025. Project 2025 by another name.
And he's arguing that for this reason, this is why senators should block Russ' vote from being confirmed. Though, A, I do find that hard to see actually happening.
Okay, so what's the White House saying about the overlap?
Well, I mean, they're sticking to what they've always said, that the president, even as a candidate, had nothing to do with Project 2025 and that he's simply carrying out the promises he made on the campaign trail. And I'll tell you, when I speak to Republicans, many of them argue, so what if there is some overlap? Ryan Williams is a longtime Republican strategist. He says issues like DEI and reworking the federal government are things that Trump ran on, that he spent millions in ad money promoting, like two genders.
There is some overlap with Project 2025 because they're basically just standard conservative views of how the government should be changed. The more controversial points of Project 2025 focused on by the Democrats really were on social issues.
And what he's talking about there are some of the specific proposals in Project 2025 that Trump has so far avoided, such as extreme measures to curtail abortion rights.
All right. So you mentioned the things where they align. Where do they differ?
Well, the plan also calls, for example, dissolving the agency in the Commerce Department that handles climate, oceans, and weather. Howard Lutnick, Trump's pick to lead the department this week, actually bucked that idea, saying he won't try to dismantle the agency. You know, we also talked about abortion before. Some allies pushed Trump to install a vocal anti-abortion rights person to a top job. Trump resisted. So while there is a lot of overlap that critics are seizing on, there are some differences to point out. But it's only been 2 weeks.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thanks for outlining the differences.
Thanks, A.
The Sundance Film Festival is winding down. For the past 40 years, independent filmmakers, film buyers, and film lovers have gathered in Park City, Utah. But after next year, NPR's Mandalit Del Barco tells us it's moving.
Cinephiles are used to trudging through the snow and waiting out in the cold to be the first to watch new independent movies. It's been a ritual in this ski resort town ever since actor and Sundance Institute founder Robert Redford came up with the idea, as he told me in 2017.
We started a film festival where at least filmmakers could come and see each other's work and form a community.
Redford said that first year, 1985, Sundance screened 25 feature films and a handful of documentaries to about 100 people. Today, that community has grown to tens of thousands of people pouring in from around the world. Since COVID, even more have been watching online. Now, organizers say it's time to find a new host city.
We're exploring Salt Lake City, Utah, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Boulder, Colorado.
Festival director Eugene Hernandez says Sundance's latest 10-year lease in Park City will end next year. A few elements of the festival may remain in town, but Hernandez says festival organizers are looking for a new home that will preserve the scrappy character of the festival's roots. Some locals welcome the move. For 31 years, shop owner Ken Whipple has run Park City Jewelers on Main Street.
Do you want Sundance to stay here or not?
No. They take up all the hotels, they take up all the restaurants, traffic's really bad, my employees can't park, and then our regular skier tourists can't come in town for like that 2 week period, and they're the ones that really have money.
Sky high hotel room prices keep some festival goers away from this increasingly wealthy town, but many Sundancers are bummed.
I think it would be sad for the festival.
Before watching a festival film at the Egyptian Theater, Park City resident Lisa Hummelberg handed out Keep Sundance in Utah stickers.
I would say Keep Sundance in Park City. They're thinking of Cincinnati. I don't think Cincinnati would be that fun. It would become more about the industry and less about the regular people. And that's what I don't want to see happen.
The festival's director of programming, Kim Yutani, says she knows people are anxious to find out where Sundance will be in 2027.
To us, it feels like wherever we end up, we will still be the Sundance Film Festival.
The final choice of host city won't be announced till the end of winter. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
After a long hiatus, the critically acclaimed series Severance is back. On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview with Adam Scott, who stars in the series as a man who chooses to have a chip implanted in his brain designed to separate his work life from his home life. Scott was also in Parks and Recreation, Big Little Lies, and The Good Place. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump has renewed his threat to impose steep tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada as early as tomorrow. He says it's a response to what he calls unfair trade practices, as well as drugs and unauthorized immigrants crossing their borders into the U.S. Many businesses are watching anxiously. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what do we think is in store this weekend?
It is hard to know. If Trump makes good on his tariff threat, it could mean Americans pay substantially more for everything from guacamole to gasoline. But that is a big if. During his first term in office, Trump imposed a lot of tariffs. He also threatened a lot of tariffs that never went into effect. So businesses are kind of in a wait-and-see mode.
Are businesses making contingency plans while they wait?
Some of them are. You know, we got trade data this week that showed a big uptick in imports during December. That suggests some businesses tried to stockpile goods before any tariffs take effect. But there are limits to that strategy. You know, warehouse space costs money. Produce, which we buy a lot of from Mexico, is perishable. General Motors said this week that it could shift some pickup truck production out of Mexico and Canada if tariffs are imposed. But CEO Mary Barra says they're not going to go down that road until they know what's actually going to happen.
We are working across our supply chain, logistics network, and assembly plans so that we are prepared to mitigate near-term impacts. What we won't do is spend large amount of capital without clarity.
For decades, the auto industry in North America has been very integrated, relying on manufacturing in all three countries. So unwinding that would be no small undertaking.
You know, you were telling us that gasoline prices could also go up. Why?
Yeah, especially in the Midwest. Oil refineries there are heavily dependent on crude oil from Canada. Those refineries are optimized for the kind of heavy sour crude that Canada produces, which is different than the light sweet oil that we produce a lot of in this country. So it's not an easy switch to make. President Trump says he wants to see lower oil and gasoline prices in this country. He's counting on that to help cut other prices. But a trade war with Canada would likely have the opposite effect.
Okay, Scott, so how about the overall economy? How might a trade war affect that?
It probably would not be enough to send the U.S. into recession, but it would slow economic growth. Matthew Martin, who's with Oxford Economics, projects that a 25% tariff on Mexico and Canada would shave a full percentage point off the U.S. GDP growth. That's one reason Martin doesn't think Trump will actually follow through.
We don't think equity markets would really like 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Would really hurt the economy, and hopefully that kind of dissuades him from going full bore.
Canada and Mexico would probably pay a larger price in any trade war, but make no mistake, the U.S. would not get off unscathed.
So Scott, do we think that this tariff threat is really a negotiating tactic for the president?
You know, it could be. We saw a dress rehearsal of that with Colombia last weekend, where Trump ultimately dropped his tariff threat once a deal was struck. But the stakes are a lot higher with Mexico and Canada. We do more than 20 times as much business with those countries as we do with Colombia.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's Friday, time for StoryCorps. In 2020, Los Angeles County firefighter Derek Bart received a terminal cancer diagnosis. Hours later, he stepped into a StoryCorps booth to share how he wanted to be remembered. Then,
he thought of someone else, an 8-year-old girl he rescued from a house fire in 1993.
It was a cold, windy night, and the wind knocked the power out. And so they were using candles to see, and they went to bed. When we got there, the room I went to was fully involved with the fire. I said, okay, if anybody's in here, they're unsurvivable. But I checked the next bedroom, which had bunk beds. So, okay, children, kids like to hide in the closet. They hide under the beds. They hide in the bathtub. So I looked across the hallway, and in a bathtub, I see this young girl. Her name is Maisha. And I notice that her face and hands are burned. So I run in there, I grab her, throw her over my shoulders, go downstairs. And it's one of those scenes where you just say, God, you know, please get me out of here. You know, this is horrible. I considered going to a hospital, but it was too emotional. So I didn't go. But for years, I always wondered how Maisha was. Well, 12 years later, I found myself in Walmart, and this girl walks by me. Her face and hands had obviously been burned. And she has a name tag that says Maisha. She says, hi, how may I help you? I say, if I get too personal, please stop me. But February 1993, I went on fire. I pulled out a little girl, and she starts crying. I'm crying. And she says, oh, my God, that's me.
Soon after, Derek found out he'd been misdiagnosed and was going to live. So he returned for another conversation, this time with Maisha.
You actually remembered me, my name, and I was shocked because out of all the thousands of people throughout your career, you still thought about me. I was just curious to know, like, why me?
In the fire service, you see a lot of tragedy. And the people that are alive today, you always think about them. And you always want to know if they're okay.
You know, of course I had some health issues, but I'm okay.
You know, the image I have of you was somebody that was just determined to fight to make it. I want you to know that you've carried me through some tough times. For that, I'm forever grateful.
I appreciate being able to be a part of that.
Yeah.
It amazes me just to know that the memory from 30 years ago is still with you, and that means a lot.
You know, it was a brief moment that you and I had our encounter back in 1993, but I hope you always remember how valued you are, that people care about you.
I thank you, and I thank God every day. I cherish this.
Maisha Oates speaking with Derek Bart at StoryCorps in Los Angeles. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. And from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Since taking office, President Trump has already fired people who prosecuted him.
Are we now going to be in a cycle of every change in administration? There's retribution against those who took positions, you know, you disagreed with.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. More on the upheaval at the Justice Department on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Divers in the Potomac River near Washington, D.C. are still working to recover bodies following Wednesday night's mid-air collision between an American Airlines regional jet and a military helicopter. All 64 people aboard the jet were killed when it collided with a U.S. Army Black Hawk as Flight 5342 from Wichita was attempting to land at Reagan National Airport. Three soldiers aboard the Black Hawk were also killed. The National Transportation Safety Board says the cockpit voice and flight data recorders from the jet have been recovered and will be analyzed. More than two dozen bodies have been found thus far. The FAA has recorded dozens of near mid-air collisions close to Reagan National Airport over the last few decades. That's according to an NPR analysis, as NPR's Robert Benincasa reports.
An NPR analysis of the Federal Aviation Administration's data on rare near mid-air collisions shows 30 reports near the airport since the late 1980s. 10 involved at least one military aircraft, 7 involved a military helicopter. Mike McCormick is the former FAA Director for Safety and Operations at all U.S. control towers.
Our system, although the safest in the world, it is still shocking when a tragedy like this occurs.
McCormick says the FAA is studying the crash to see if immediate changes should be made.
This is NPR News. The Commerce Department says consumer prices rose in December at an annual pace of 2.6%. That's higher than the year-over-year jump seen in November. Earlier this week, the Federal Reserve decided to leave interest rates unchanged. Joan Jett, Lady Gaga, Green Day, and a reunion of Nirvana, minus the late Kurt Cobain, were among the performers who took to separate concert stages near Los Angeles last night for Fire Aid. It was a benefit concert to raise money for those affected by this month's wildfires in Southern California.
Valentine's Day, crying in the hotel, I know you didn't mean to.
Billie Eilish was among the performers at the Kia Forum and the Intuit Dome. Comedian Billy Crystal was one of the thousands of people whose house was destroyed by the Palisades fire.
We'll laugh again, we're going to listen to music again, and we will be okay. So tonight, from Altadena to Malibu to the Pacific Palisades, let's show the world who we are. We're Los Angeles, one city, one heart, L.A. strong!
Before last night, the organizers of Fire Aid announced they'd already raised more than $60 million. The fires destroyed more than 16,000 homes, businesses, and other structures. Stocks on Wall Street are higher this morning. The Dow's up 64 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
We begin with the aftermath of Wednesday night's mid-air collision. Authorities have recovered the cockpit voice and flight data recorders from the passenger jet that sank into the Potomac River after an Army helicopter crashed into it. At a media briefing yesterday, National Transportation Safety Board Chair Jennifer Homendy said investigators will investigate, not speculate.
You need to give us time. We need to verify information. to make sure it is accurate, that's best for you, that's important for the families, it's important for legislators who are seeking answers.
Meanwhile, the rescue operation turned into a recovery operation. The jet's 60 passengers included young figure skaters, their parents, and coaches. Two athletes and two coaches came from one of the oldest skating clubs in the country in Massachusetts. From member station GBH, Craig Lamolt has this report.
The ice at the skating club of Boston is usually buzzing with activity, but it was silent on Thursday as 1956 Olympic champion Tenley Albright, for whom this rink is named, spoke to reporters.
I really can't believe that it happened.
Looking at the ice, Albright said she could picture those this club lost.
The coaches always stood at that entrance. The skaters just flew all over the ice, doing remarkable things, inspiring all of us.
Among the victims Wednesday were club members 13-year-old Gina Hahn and 16-year-old Spencer Lane. They were on their way home from a training camp for top figure skating prospects following the U.S. Championships in Wichita. Both of their mothers were on the flight as well. Elin Schran organizes skating events and remembers Lane's reaction after performing at his first professional show with her company.
He came to me and smiling ear to ear, saying, I get it now. I understand. He started to discover this connection with the audience and that joy that he was giving to other people through his gift. And he said, please let me skate again with you next year.
Hahn was remembered by other skaters for her bright smile, high-pitched voice, and ability to make jumps beyond what seemed possible for a 13-year-old. Misha Mitrofanov and Elisa Efimova, who just won the U.S. National Pairs Championship, remember watching the younger skaters on the ice.
The amount that they were able to achieve in such a short amount of time was absolutely remarkable. It was
their progress that made them stand out personally for me. Yeah. Everyday improvement.
Also on the plane were two coaches from the skating club of Boston, Vadim Nomov and Zhenya Shishkova. They were married and a former world champion pairs team themselves. The club's CEO, Doug Zegheib, says the coaches were strict, but there was more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. They were so kind. But they had high standards, and the combination really worked with their kids because they felt the support, but they also knew where their bar was.
Their son, Max, is a figure skater who placed fourth at the national championships, but was on a different flight home. The skating community is a tight-knit group, and among those gathering to mourn Wednesday was former Olympian Nancy Kerrigan, who trained at this club back when it was in another location. Kerrigan talked about the lessons learned in a sport where you fall a lot.
You get back up, keep on trying, and even when it's hard, you get back up. Even when you're crying, hurt, pain, you get back up and move forward. It's not easy, but that's what we all have to do now together.
The loss is tragically reminiscent of a 1961 plane crash that led to the deaths of the entire U.S. figure skating team. Zegheib says almost half of the team that died in that incident also had ties to this Massachusetts club. He says it's taken decades for the skating world to recover from that loss, and now there's a new tragedy to face. For NPR News, I'm Craig Lamolt in Norwood, Massachusetts.
What started as a motion to do more to restrict immigration to Germany has now become something bigger.
It has erupted into a fierce national debate over the degree to which the country should allow its most extreme political elements into mainstream politics. And at the center of this debate is the man who is the frontrunner to become Germany's next chancellor.
NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us to discuss this. So set the scene for us, Rob. How did all this start?
So this all started with a parliamentary motion to restrict immigration from Friedrich Merz. He's the head of the Christian Democratic Union, a center-right party that's ahead in the polls and will likely win the most votes in Germany's election next month. And that means Merz will likely be Germany's next chancellor.
All right. So what did he do in parliament this week?
Well, he brought forth a motion to further restrict immigration to Germany. And this comes on the heels of recent deadly attacks committed by migrants. Now, on the face of it, there was nothing off about Merz's motion in parliament about this, but it was how he was going to pass this motion that really upset much of parliament and many Germans.
Upset. So what was so upsetting to lawmakers about that?
Well, none of the mainstream parties were interested in voting with Merz's party on this proposal, but there was one party that was very keen to join him, and that's the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party. which is considered by Germany's political establishment as an extremist right-wing party. The AfD has advocated deporting all Germans with a migration background. Some of its members use Nazi slogans, and the party is under domestic surveillance for the threat that it poses to Germany's democracy.
So, Rob, just a guess here, but because of Germany's history in World War II, I'd imagine that a party like AfD is probably worrying a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right. And since World War II, there's been a consensus among Germany's mainstream political parties that extremist parties must never be allowed in government again. And when the AfD first gained popularity a decade ago, Merz's party and Germany's other mainstream parties made a pact to never cooperate with the AfD. This was called the firewall. But now Merz is signaling that he's open to cooperating with the AfD on this immigration motion. And here's how he defended his decision.
Eine richtige Entscheidung wird nicht dadurch falsch.
And he's saying here that the right decision does not become wrong because the wrong people have made it. The decision, he said, is still right.
Okay, how are other mainstream parties responding to all this?
Lots of anger. As Merz defended himself, a yelling match began in parliament, and Chancellor Olaf Scholz finally took the podium. Here's what he said.
Viele Bürgerinnen und Bürger haben darauf und auf ihr
Scholz said that 3 weeks ago, Merz promised never to cooperate with the AfD, and voters trusted him. What are these words worth now, he asked. Former Chancellor Angela Merkel, who's in the same party as Merz, also has criticized him for doing this.
Any indication of why Merz did this?
Well, there is an election in a few weeks, and it's possible Merz is cooperating with the AfD on immigration because up to now, the AfD has owned this issue, and it's led to high poll numbers. They're now in second place, and Elon Musk has recently come out to support them. So the logic goes, if Merz's party can steal some of that spotlight, perhaps he can chip into that support and take some of those voters to his party. But many are blaming him for playing a dangerous game with Germany's democracy on this.
That's NPR's Berlin correspondent, Rob Schmitz. Rob, thanks.
Thanks.
This is NPR News.
In our weekly roundtable, we look at a confusing funding freeze announced by the White House, a freeze that was later rescinded. Next time, here and now.
NPR is on the radio, online, and at your fingertips, wherever you go. Stay connected. Take the news with you on your smartphone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. Figure skating legend Dick Button died yesterday in New York at the age of 95. He won two Olympic gold medals, including one held outdoors, and also five consecutive world championships. And he was the first to land a double axel and a triple jump in competition. Later, he became an Emmy award-winning TV analyst who taught viewers the basics and nuances of a complex sport. He also created professional events that let skaters earn money after their careers as amateurs. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The 67th Grammy Awards take place Sunday in Los Angeles. Now, one category in particular has fans on the edge of their seats, and that's Best New Artist. But let's take a closer look at some of those nominees. Sabrina Carpenter had really one of the biggest songs of the summer. So you can't sleep, baby, I know that's the soul. But check out her discography, and you'll see a list of six albums going all the way back to 2015. So why is she up for Best New Artist? Stephen Thompson of NPR Music is here to help make sense of it all. Stephen, I'm still keeping my fingers crossed for Best New Public Radio Host. It's only been 13 years, so I figure I got a chance still, right?
You know what? You keep plugging away, buddy.
Someday. Now, okay, so what can you tell us about the eight nominees for this award? I mean, are there any new artists than Sabrina Carpenter?
Most of them are newer than Sabrina Carpenter, but basically you can sort the eight nominees kind of into two categories. You've got your major pop breakthroughs, Sabrina Carpenter, Chapel Roan, Benson Boone, Shaboozey, and Teddy Swims. They all had songs that were inescapable during this period of eligibility. Then you've got kind of left field artists. Doechii is this hugely dynamic rapper. Ray is the kind of polymath genre straddler that the Grammys love. And Krungbin has been playing vibey worldly music for ages. Their first album came out almost a decade ago. They've got five records in all, but this was kind of the year that they broke through to where they're playing stadiums.
I mean, what's the Grammys' own criteria for what makes someone eligible to be nominated as this Best New Artist category?
Well, their criteria are pretty Byzantine. It's a lot of stuff about how many songs they've released, how many times they've submitted for the award, that sort of thing. I think the big thing is they don't want people who've been up for a bunch of Grammys before, but they don't want to punish people who've had a slow rise to success. And that's where you get stuff like Krungbin with the five albums, Sabrina Carpenter with the six. But this was kind of the year that they broke through, and that's kind of good enough for this category.
So that reminds me of sports. In Major League Baseball, there can be a player that has 100 at-bats one year and is great, but then he's still a rookie the next year because he didn't get the amount of at-bats that would disqualify him. So yeah, like a period of eligibility makes sense to me. So how common isn't that for artists to be nominated in the Best New Artist category to have released like five or six albums?
I mean, five or six is definitely a lot, but there's a pretty long history, at least in the last couple decades, of artists who are on their second, third, fourth album. As recently as last year, you had a group called The War and Treaty. They were nominated. They've been around for a long time. Fountains of Wayne was nominated for its third album on a major label. One of the reasons they've loosened the rules as much as they have is you've had several cases where artists have been disqualified from this category. Most famously, probably Whitney Houston back in the 80s was disqualified for Best New Artist because she had recorded a couple of duets. She had not broken through into the public's consciousness at all, but was kind of disqualified on a technicality and would have almost certainly won had she been nominated. So they're trying to prevent people from being like, where's Sabrina Carpenter? You know, that's the tricky tightrope they're trying to walk.
So Stephen, I mean, if these artists aren't technically new, why don't they just change the name of the award?
Yeah, I've been suggesting this for a few years now. Really, the best way to think about this category is as Best Breakthrough Artist. Just kind of make a note in your head every time they say Best New Artist, just think breakthrough. Artists who've really entered the public's consciousness in the last year, and that's really what they're going for.
So that's what I need to do, Stephen. I need to break through into the public radio listeners'
consciousness.
That's
right, man. Hey, I believe in you. 13 years, you're just a pup.
Fingers crossed. That's Stephen Thompson of NPR Music. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Tomorrow may bring the opening shot in a sprawling series of trade wars.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company that offers data-driven advertising solutions for businesses big and small. Billboardsforbusiness.com. And by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life. Learn more at glassdoor.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. President Donald Trump says he is still planning to impose import taxes, also known as tariffs, on goods from Canada and Mexico starting tomorrow. In the past, he's floated a rate of 25%, but there could be exceptions, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Trump reiterated his tariff threats yesterday. The penalties would be aimed at getting Canada and Mexico to do more to stem the flow of undocumented immigrants and fentanyl across the U.S. border. But there are reports that Trump would exempt Canadian oil imports from tariffs that could raise gas prices for U.S. consumers. Canada and Mexico have said they would slap retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products. S&P Global Ratings says the impact on Mexico's economy from tariffs would be 11 times greater than the effect on the U.S., and the hit to Canada's economy would be 5 times higher. Still, Oxford Economics estimates that higher U.S. tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China, plus retaliatory tariffs, would shave more than a percentage point off U.S. economic growth this year. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 35 points. That's less than a tenth of a percent. The S&P 500 is up 0.7%. The NASDAQ is up 1.3%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.513%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts. And by Sony Pictures Classics, presenting I'm Still Here, starring Fernanda Torres. A woman reinvents herself after suffering an injustice, now playing select cities.
Among the tens of thousands of people whose lives were upended by this month's wildfires were many of our colleagues. At our parent company's Southern California outlet, LAist, at least 15 were displaced and 4 people lost their homes entirely. The fires also affected a number of people in the Marketplace family, including our David Brancaccio, whose home in Altadena is completely gone. Yesterday, David took a look at a key constraint on rebuilding. Where will Californians find the contractors needed with the skills to build from the ground up? Today, it's about building community.
The 2-bedroom house Mary and I bought 2 months and 1 day before the fire is now mainly a 34 by 34 foot sandbox of ash and cracked stucco. The 2 houses to our right, ruins. The 3 houses to our left, the 2 in the back of our garden, same. Sandra's place is also a total loss. She's just across the street.
We added on to the house.
Yeah.
I mean, if I hadn't added on, the house would have been paid for, but
sure.
I still have a mortgage.
Yeah, that's true.
And I hate that the vultures are coming around.
The vultures, as she sees them, already waving lowball offers to people in distress to buy up property at fire sale prices. Piece of advice from a fellow fire survivor: if you can, do not sell now. The EPA and the county will clean up the toxics and debris in the coming months, and just that will increase the value of your property. Now, people will do what they have to do, but it's clear the firestorm is already causing an enduring exodus. My new community here is, against our will, in flux.
2743 Glen Ave, 2743 Glen.
Since we can't get mail at our burned-out address, they're setting up at a parking lot of the post office down in Pasadena. You get on a line, show ID, and the postal crew checks if anything's forwarded.
Raymond Ave, 3984.
The vibe is nurturing. Apparent strangers checking in. Did you get any sleep last night? A woman shakes her head. All walks. Doesn't matter who you are. You want your mail. It's this parking lot. There's something leveling here. Equals in trauma. But for how long?
Without forethought and without coordination, we're going to risk a rebuild that amplifies the region's inequality and also puts people in Altadena at more risk from the changing environmental landscape.
Political scientist Megan Mullen is faculty director of the UCLA Luskin Center for Innovation, who understands people need shelter and need it now. But she argues rebuilding homes is only part of what's needed if we want to end up with a vibrant community versus a collection of new houses.
Early rebuilding can even serve as a barrier to implementing community priorities that might emerge through a longer, more engaged process.
An engaged process means the people who live here set priorities.
We don't want decision-making in the next 6 months that preempts the kind of longevity that makes the place so special.
David Chavez teaches the history of Southern California at Compton Community College. He and his family are back at their place just over the line in North Pasadena after the evacuation order was lifted. The house survived, but he's wondering about the nature of this place.
It's a matter of building the political pressure to move policy to reflect the needs of the community.
Chavez and his partner set up on their driveway to get N95 masks and other donations to neighbors in need. And you can see other people-powered mutual aid stations that have popped up in parking lots nearby.
I just saw a flyer for a gathering, a protest with the title of Altadena's Not for Sale.
What we know doesn't work in these situations is when communities simply told what's happening and they're not at the center of the decision-making, when everyone's kind of racing toward getting back to some past state without thinking about some of the consequences of the future.
Sam Carter works on urban transformation as founding principal of Resilient Cities Catalyst. He says taking the time to build resilience, he says, can yield returns that include cold hard cash, regarding something I very much worry about when planning my own rebuild. Will we ever be able to get insurance again?
What are those community scale actions that could actually shift the risk profile and could actually change the way insurers look at these communities and might actually shift risk to an extent that insurance could actually go down in some of these communities?
I'll be on this beat for a long time. In Altadena, California, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
He's a mighty good leader, he's a mighty good leader, he's a mighty good leader, all our way from up your heaven. He's a mighty good leader, all the way. Let Jesus lead you, let Jesus lead you, let Jesus lead you, all our way, all our way.